Okay, I'll introduce our panel from the American Folklife Center while they're swapping out equipment. Nikki Saylor is head of the American Folklife Center Archive at the Library of Congress. She leads a team of archivists, ethnomusicologists, and folklorists who curate multi-format collections that document folk culture from around the world. From the earliest field recordings made in the 1890s on wax cylinder through born digital collections such as StoryCorps. The AFC Archive is the nation's oldest and largest archives of ethnographic documentation, including folk songs, stories, and other creative expressions of people from diverse communities. Saylor served as head of digital research and publishing at the University of Iowa Libraries from 2007 to 2012. She has also worked in the public library and the regional humanities center devoted to the languages and cultures of the Upper Midwest since earning her MA in library and information studies from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2004. And she holds a journalism BA from Iowa State University. Maggie Crucy is a folklorist and cataloger at the American Folklife Center, Library of Congress, where she creates collection-level descriptions of the center's archival collections of recorded sound, video, film, photographs, and manuscripts, and works on issues of description and access for the center's digital collections. She is a co-editor of the American Folklore Society Ethnographic Thesaurus, an online control vocabulary for folklore, ethnomusicology, and ethnology. She received her doctorate in folklore and folklife at the University of Pennsylvania in 1995. Guha Shankar is folklife specialist at the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center. His work includes serving as project director for the Civil Rights History Project, a national oral history collecting initiative of the library, along with coordinating and teaching in the AFC's Field School for Cultural Documentation and producing multimedia projects in collaboration with colleagues in the center and in other institutions. For the center's commemorative project on Alan Lomax's 1938 collecting trip to Michigan, he serves as the editor and co-producer of the film clips that have been created for various access and outreach projects. And Todd Harvey is a reference archivist at the American Folklife Center, Library of Congress. He coordinates acquisitions for the archive and curates the Alan Lomax collection. His recent book, Michigan I.O., Alan Lomax and the 1938 Library of Congress Folk Song Expedition, was co-published by the Library of Congress and Dust to Digital Records. And they're going to be speaking about Alan Lomax. So let's welcome the people from the AFC.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here at my first ARSC meeting. Today we're going to be discussing a radical collaboration, or certainly radical by federal government standards, with external partners that's breathed life into an important but largely undiscovered field collection. The project not only garnered significant media attention, but more importantly, it raised awareness of and sustained affinity for a collection in the communities of origin and well beyond. So in June 1938, 23-year-old Alan Lomax, assistant in charge of the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress, secured money to support a trip to the Lake States, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, over a two-year period to record folk songs. He never made it to Minnesota. He only spent a day in Wisconsin because he was unprepared for the wealth of what he found in Michigan. The trip yielded about 1,000 songs and tunes that were captured on disc, and he did some shot some film as well. So with the exception of a few lumberjack songs, some Lake Sailor songs, and maybe the Irish fiddle tunes that were released on historic LPs, the full range of the recordings, lots of the foreign language stuff, Croatian, Finnish, German, Hungarian, Italian, and so on, went largely undiscovered until now. So flash forward to 2013, 75 years after the original trip, and digital restorations of his deteriorating discs were made and augmented with new research, as was the film. And these things were incorporated into new products and events, and forthcoming repatriation projects with local communities have been planned, and it was all through collective efforts of the Folklife Center, of the Association for Cultural Equity, the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures, publishers Dust to Digital, and the Michigan Traditional Arts Program of the Michigan State University Museum. The project had already begun to coalesce by the time I arrived at the Folk Life Center about 16 months ago. This vision was sketched out by Todd Harvey, who along with Guha Shankar did the lion's share of the engagement work out in Michigan, and a lot of the production work as well. Maggie, who you'll be hearing from too, has intimate knowledge of the collection, its metadata, its history, and that kind of thing. In the interest of time, I'll let them talk specifically about the podcast and the ebooks and what have you that came from it. But this rolling tide of projects and events really was a great undertaking and something I think we want to use as a model to work with others in the years to come. Thanks.
Yeah, hi, I'm Todd Harvey. It's also my first ARSC meeting, and I would reflect to you all that you're a very friendly crowd of people. It's a joy to be here, and I want to thank you for having us on a rainy day. The trip was very interesting to me to begin with. It's a Midwestern trip, and I'm a Midwesterner, We tried to create a multifaceted project that would allow us to fail in some ways, and the project would still move ahead, right? So if one aspect didn't pan out as we thought it might, then others would. And the kind of central piece of the project is an e-book. The publishing office had worked with an earlier Lomax book, the 1959-1960 trip, and they published it in a very traditional manner through W.W. Norton, and it was about a three-year endeavor, you know, and most of that was the everything was at the publisher, and they were just working through it, and that's great, that's very traditional, but they came to us and said, well, can we do something a little quicker? We want to do an e-book, and so from the time that they said, go, write this, to the time it came out was almost exactly 12 months, and that's a very cool thing, And I think also that the ebook platform really fits ethnographic materials, because when you're reading about a field trip, there are so many materials that kind of feed into it. And in this particular book, there are about 20,000 words, so it's a very short manuscript, and 52, I believe, digital objects that include manuscript materials, photographs, sound recordings, moving image, and so as you're reading about something, you can see the map, the photograph, the sound recording, the document, and so I want to just show you a couple aspects of the book. This is Apo Juhani, the great UP Finnish squeeze box player. And that's the front cover of the book, and we're going to use Lance alluded earlier to a PDF version that you can download. If you don't happen to own one of these fancy little toys, one of a few people in the world who don't know, it is the most popular platform I think for ebooks, but it's understandable that a lot of people don't have them. So can you let's just scroll down a little bit, if you will, sir. Can you go down to where there's a little content, maybe? Sure. Yeah. So we started each chapter. Go back. We started each chapter with a road map. That's Alan Lomax's map of Detroit. That's where he started the field trip and made his first recordings on the trip. And the book itself runs chronologically through the 3-month field trip. And just scroll down so they can get an idea of what's in the. There's a telegram. We're still using those at the Library of Congress. and photographs. If you'll scroll a little further along, this is a dust jacket. No, you can't click in on that. In the ebook, you can click in on it and enlarge it and look at the. he's documenting a double barrel Serbian flute that he also made film clips of. Well, that's pretty slick. And anyway, you get the idea. The text runs in among all these documents. So it's a kind of fun way to experience. And there's some film clips. And Guha will tell you later what we had to do or what he had to do with Jim Leary in order to get these in presentable fashion. So what I thought I would like to do is to just to read you a little bit out of the book and so you can experience it. This is from the top. Alan Lomax parked his Chrysler in downtown Detroit and checked into the Hotel Montcalm. In his hotel room, Alan reviewed the plan to record briefly in the metropolis and then move northward, making a rapid reconnaissance survey of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. As it turned out, he would depart Michigan after 3 months of fieldwork, having exhausted his time and passable weather, finding it to be the most richly varied area for folk music that I ever visited, combining as it did the lusty tradition of the Northern Woods singer with an infinitely varied pattern of immigrant, European, Indian, and even Appalachian and Southern Negro music. Things flowed smoothly for a few days. Alan met with J.D. Newsom and other staff members in the Detroit Federal Writers Project at their office on Woodward Avenue to glean contacts throughout the state. He began to document the ethnic communities in Detroit, Serbs, Hungarians, Poles, Romanians, and African Americans. On Friday, August 5th, he ventured into the predominantly Serbian Clairepoint neighborhood north of downtown along the river. He encountered for the first time the Serbian svivali, shepherd's music played on a double end-blown duct flute. He made a careful drawing of the recordings on the recording's dust jacket and shot 2 minutes of silent film footage. Alan opened the disc with a slate voicing the irony in encountering such a rural genre in the shadow of the Chrysler plant. He interviewed singer Stefan Basrak about himself, Serbian music, and the Detroit Serbian community. Pejo Tomic sang an epic song about the 1912 Serbian war with the Turks, punctuating passages with his gusla. This one-string bowed lute is the accompaniment of choice for epic songs, a staple in rural Serbian repertoire. As most Detroit Serbs emigrated from rural areas, the svivali and gusla followed. Lomax's disc cutter spun and his camera rolled. It spun too on August 6 as he recorded more Serbian songs and instrumental tunes on the dudek, dipla, and gusla in the River Rouge neighborhood south of downtown and separated from the riverfront by the U.S. steel plant. His notes show a long interview with gusla player Stefan Rekovic, I think, who was born in 1885 and emigrated to the United States in 1904, to play the gusla. He told Alan, you sit behind the master and put your hand on the bow hand and your other on the fretting hand. Ija Sanović, I think, of 35 Orchid Street played several songs on the dipla. The next day, he recorded singing at a Polish-Serbian wedding a few miles north of downtown in the Hamtramck neighborhood. Alan made a detailed description of the wedding ceremony and its attendant rites. He called it a musical vertigo. While the older generation reveled in polkas, the younger Poles howled for jazz. On Monday, the 8th, he visited the Hungarian Del Rey neighborhood, just north of River Rouge, armed with a letter of introduction from the WPA to a Mr. Kaldor of the Association of Hungarian Weeklies in America in the Del Rey neighborhood. He found singers and instrumentalists, including a cymbalon player, bringing his haul over 4 days to 21 discs, 3.5 hours. A Mrs. Mate sang 2 verses of a lyric song, The Fisher Boy's Sweetheart, retelling the story with a strong immigrant's accent after singing. And can we listen to that? This is Mrs. Mate. Ne sirki plan, vi sajena čas, Of her, Alan wrote wistfully in his field notebook, Mrs. Mate, the gay, temperamental, romantic, skinny, glamorous, sentimental Catholic Hungarian washerwoman, her husband so kind and her dead son on the wall admired across an eternal groaning ironing board. She works sometimes 3 days and nights without sleep, sends or gives her money away. Has a head full of sweetness and memories and a beautiful garden. She feeds me ginger ale and cookies and wants to do my washing free. She is the maid of all work of the old regime in Hungary, and she's beautiful and sad and dead, and I hope she goes to heaven. She posed for a photograph in her lush flower garden by her dress, a 19th century Eastern European woman. Then trouble found Alan Lomax. And if you'd like to know what kind of trouble he got into, I urge you to go to the Dust to Digital website or the iBookstore and purchase this wonderful publication. But also, there are the project is Dust to Digital. Did I say that? Dust to Digital. There are a number of podcasts on the American Folklife Center website. There's information about public programming relating to the project, and all sorts of other fun things. And so I guess I'm going to turn it over to Maggie and let her talk about metadata. Thanks.
So this is the part where there's no pictures or sound. We're talking about the catalog cards and all of that. All right. Anyway, it's wonderful to be here and great to see you all. The part of this overall story that I'm telling is the story of the journey that Alan Lomax's field documentation took after the 250 discs returned to the Library of Congress. In particular, it's the story of how the notes that Alan wrote on about music and songs and the drawings on the disc sleeves in the field became the data that will drive the presentation and access for these recordings and film on the library's updated website this year. So in addition to the ebook publication and publication of a CD set in Michigan, these will also be available on the library's website soon. First, I want to acknowledge that there are many people here, Matt Barton, who gave a great talk about this Lomax field trip some years ago, sponsored by the local ARSC chapter in D.C., and sound engineers, including Brad McCoy, who transferred the discs to digital for our colleague Jim Leary 7 or 8 years ago, and my colleagues here, who can tell you a great more about the details about the recordings themselves. And we will have some time for questions at the end. What interested me in Lomax's correspondence after his recording trip to Michigan is that it shows that he developed an increasingly in-depth and systematic approach to creating the documentation in the field. And I believe that was influenced by the fact that these recordings were being cataloged at the library. 18 months after returning from Michigan, on July 20th, 1940, Lomax wrote a two-page letter to Charles L. Todd, who was using a Library of Congress recording machine and discs in the FSA migrant workers' camps in California. This letter and the audio are available as one of the American Memory presentations that we are currently moving to what the library calls Project One, which is an essential new infrastructure and web design to support this older content. And at the same time, we are moving these new presentations into Project One. And one of those collections is the Civil Rights History Project videos, which Guha directed, and they're officially launching next Monday. In this 1940 letter, which I'm going to quote a little bit from so you get some more of Alan's voice, Lomax offers 7 points which will make your materials more useful to the archive, and he says, quote, much more easily cataloged, which is where my cataloger's ears perked up. Alan writes, give your trip a name, viz. John Doe's Expedition to Kalamazoo, or something of that sort. So a year and a half later, was Michigan still on Lomax's mind? Why did he suggest that the trip should be called, Expedition to Kalamazoo? Here, Lomax is considering the entire field trip, which is an extended event encompassing a series of multiple events and works captured on time-based media as a starting point for the collection-level description, which is a practice that's still followed in the archive and cataloging today. His next few instructions to Charles Todd are pretty basic for everyone here would know this, but he says, number the records in the order they are recorded on the top of each record envelope. Scratch or write in the center of each side of the disc the letter A or B, thus identifying the record side. The strips on each side should be numbers 1, 2, 3, and et cetera in the order of their cutting, and each of these strips should be identified by giving the title of the song as the singer gives it, followed by the recordist title or another title, the name of the singers with the instrumentation, the place of the recording, and the date. The slip cover where notations are generally made should then look like this. And he gave a full example in this letter about how this cataloging metadata should appear. So when these Michigan recordings were cataloged in the library around 1940, the titles and disc identifying numbers were typed on to catalog cards, one title per card, so there were 2 to 7 cards per disc. The catalogers were workers for the WPA, and the WPA project number was stamped on each card. This model that Lomax describes in his letter is exactly how the data appears on the cards. So the cataloging was influencing, in my view, how Lomax was giving advice to other people who were out doing collection projects in the field. And the typists or catalogers who were creating the cards were using the slip covers, which Todd showed you an example of, as the source for their data. This resulted in 875 catalog cards for 250 discs. Before moving on to Lomax's other 3 points in this letter, which are also of interest in relation to the Michigan trip, I'm going to go back to 2009, which was my first ARSC conference in D.C., and I was very excited to give a talk about the American Folklife Center's newly available online searchable database for this particular card catalog, including scans of the 34,000 cards that comprise the shelf list. It's an incomplete shelf list, but for 10,000 or so of the pre-1950s discs in the archives collections, including these Michigan discs and many others recorded by Alan, by his father, Johnny Lomax, and by Herbert Halpert and many other noted recordists. So in our current project to make the Michigan recordings available on the library's website, Bert Lyons started by exporting the metadata from the card catalog database. So it was an advantage to us that the material was not just written on cards anymore. Then the data required additional work for a number of reasons, which you could easily probably imagine. As Todd indicated, the singers on these recordings were singing in at least 12 languages, including Polish, Italian, Serbian, Croatian, Romanian, Hungarian, Lithuanian, Canadian, French, German, English, and Swedish. Neither Lomax nor the catalogers necessarily knew all the languages, of course, and many of the catalog cards, therefore, ended up being blank. They said either French or foreign or something to that effect. And then sometimes if they had somebody around who had expertise in these languages, somebody would write handwritten notations on the cards. So we had incomplete data. There was also the challenge of the spelling of the singers' names, although they were very complicated. Lomax really made his best effort to try to get them accurately. And here's where our colleague Jim Leary, who partnered with us on this. He did a lot of work in Michigan to track down family members of the singers, to unearth new information about their communities, and he shared his research with Todd, who updated this spreadsheet using the Lomax's maps and the field notebooks from the Alan Lomax collection. The discs themselves have been copied to 10-inch preservation reels around the 1960s and 70s, and the discs were moved to the library's Packard campus facility with all the other recorded sound collections around 7 years ago. So there was also a lot of issues with the varying condition of some of the discs. It was an issue during the initial transfer and the more recent transfers. Some of them were lost and some were not able to be transferred. They were not all in great shape. For Jim Leary's publication of the Michigan recordings on CD, new transfers have been made from the discs. For the website, the access copies of the audio are transfers from the preservation reels. For the Michigan collection on the ELSI website, we've decided to present each side of each recording rather than each of the 875 cuts, in part to give the researcher better access to the performance context of each of the recordings in the field. So the metadata for the 875 cards had to be consolidated to describe 500 or so disc sides with the help of our colleague Tanya Brown. So if we go back to Alan Lomax's 1940 letter to Charles Todd, we find in his points number 5, 6, and 7 that capturing information about the context for the recordings was foremost on Lomax's agenda for these field projects. He wrote to Todd, "Naturally, we hope that you'll be able to furnish us with a great deal of additional materials surrounding the recordings, both in terms of careful field notes and interesting interviews recorded with the songs. You'll find a questionnaire enclosed, which has been used in the field to some extent. My personal opinion is that it's valuable to get the informant talking eloquently for himself rather than interrupt him or push him with questions. The recording interview can be as significant as the song itself." And his sixth point was very much influenced by his experience in Michigan and probably also by his experience recording for the library in Haiti the year before in 1937. Lomax writes, "It's very important to record the tunings of all instruments which play a part in the music, to photograph the instruments, get the informant to explain how he plays it. In the case of unusual instruments, it would be worthwhile to make accurate drawings or send the instruments where they could be drawn to scale. If part singing is recorded, it would be a real contribution to record the parts in the harmony separately. This can be done by shifting the singers in front of the microphone." So he had been encountering these unusual instruments in Michigan, and he was also encountering unusual harmonies in the group singing of immigrants from the Balkans and from Northern Europe. In the card catalog database, when we were building it, we added a separate field to enable search by medium of performance of the instrumentation named in the description, because many researchers seek this information to search it across our collections. But in the new online presentation, this information is folded back into the note field. I expect there is a certain tension between launching a lot of materials in a uniform data structure and then having the granularity that you really some people would want for certain specialized kind of research. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is that field recordings are complex and they need more contextual documentation than cataloging structures normally allow, which is what you all are pretty familiar with, I think, here. The data structures and rules developed for cataloging don't always accommodate rich description for field recordings very well, and they don't always provide the best access that we could desire. I'm going to finish with Lomax's final advice to Charles Todd. He says, "As you know, valuable materials to be had from comparison of different versions of the same song from different regions, so also are different performances of the same songs in the same community by different singers, or the same song by different members of the family, or the same song by the same performers at different times. Therefore, it's not so important to us that materials always be rehearsed without a mistake or hesitation the great beauty of field recordings is that the performers take their own time and do things their own way, feeling that if they make a mistake, they can try again. The results are such that no commercial recording company can ever hope to achieve. With best wishes for a successful trip, I am Ellen Lomax, Assistant in Charge, Archive of American Folk Song, Library of Congress. So the brief journey I've described, I've left out the complications related to the rights information, which also involved contacting the descendants of the family in Michigan about these materials, a lot of other complications. And in general, the metadata just takes a long time to get it ready for the launch of the new material, but we are really looking forward to doing it, and I call my colleagues for that. And Guhas, I'm going to move right into the Lomax's using film to capture these contexts that he really wanted to get a hold of, so thanks.
All right. Thank you to the program committee, to our hosts here at UNC Chapel Hill, Susan Huyenga, the moderator, Carrie Janelle, the panelists, and my fellow panelists. It's especially gratifying to be here at UNC, which is my alma mater. I was going to say I was afraid of dating myself by mentioning the date I graduated from Carolina, but as fellow alumnus Kip Lornell in inimitable fashion reminded me just this morning, God, there are some really old fuckers here, referring to ourselves, so that ship has sailed. Accordingly, Tar Heel Proud, Carolina graduating class of 1982, not coincidentally the same year that a skinny 17-year-old named Michael Jordan, whom you may have heard of, hit the big shot in the finals, giving this esteemed Dean Smith his first national basketball championship. Anyway, there you have it. Since I have wandered down the long and winding nostalgia road, I was reminded that I was introduced to Alan Lomax, or rather introduced myself to Alan Lomax sometime in 1987 during an after party at the annual Festival of American Folklife in Washington, D.C. I turned away from a performance of Zuni music in the hotel ballroom and ran smack into a somewhat portly man holding a beer. As his beer spilled down the front of his shirt, I stammered apologies, and in return he said something along the lines of, "Well, I think you owe me a beer." Being newly inducted into the ranks of the folk mafia in Washington, I was not completely tuned into the famous and near-famous individuals in the ranks of folklorists, so Alan's prodigious and long-lived career, his mythic field-collecting projects, and equally legendary irascibility had not yet made its way into my consciousness. I was made aware of the latter quality shortly thereafter when colleagues who had been subjected to his rough tongue over the years appreciatively acknowledged my having soaked Alan, which was a bit baffling at that moment since I said I had no knowledge of him. Since that somewhat innocent time, I have subsequently been saturated, and I use the term advisedly, by the astonishing breadth and range of Alan's corpus of materials, his all-encompassing vision in recording, and thereby expanding our collective knowledge of world performance traditions, and from my perspective as a film person, his sustained work in the realm of motion images. Many of us here might be well familiar with televised programs he produced for PBS as the American Patchwork series in 1991, or the documentary Where the Land Where the Blues Began in 1982, earlier still Os Os We Os in 1953, or the 1947 film To Hear Your Banjo Play. Matt Barton, Todd Harvey, and others who are well informed of Alan's work, either through personal acquaintance with him or as curators of his materials, would be well able to explain those to you. Alan's fascination for uncovering and documenting the historical traces of patterns of cultural behavior and embedded traditions in the expressive culture of work of cultural groups later led him to pioneering work in choreometrics, a field of cultural expression and movement analysis that is finding favor of late among contemporary scholars. Keeping these sort of brief highlights in mind frames some of the many intellectual preoccupations and projects of the man. So let me turn, without further delay, to the really good stuff, and to the eight reels of film that Nikki alluded to earlier that Alan shot while also collecting nearly 1,000 songs during that enormously productive 3 months in the summer and fall of 1938. It was not mentioned before. Maybe I'm giving away the game. But several additional film rolls were stolen from his car during that trip. So the historical record and the point of images is sadly all too partial. I had the distinct pleasure, as Todd has had before me, to actually go back to some of those communities of origin. I was in Houghton, Michigan. Todd did some work up in Traverse City. And I made the plea that whoever might have those eight rolls of film, remaining rolls of film, might return them to the Library of Congress without penalty. We're librarians, we try to do our good deeds, but nobody took up my offer. So it may be the oldest amount of oldest collection material still out on indefinite loan, I think, but I'm not quite sure. Ha ha, sorry. So, on to the clips. The ones I'm going to show you are just a few of the 15 performances that are included in a documentary that my colleague Jim Leary, University of Wisconsin Folklorist, has been mentioned before, and noted cultural historian of the region, and I produced and edited for his forthcoming magnum opus, 150-song CD-DVD set of archival recordings of the region's musical communities. It includes recording from other folks and the people who record in the region, but more than 40 full-length tracks from Allen's 1938 trip to the Upper Midwest. The film documentary is based on high-def video transferred from the original 16-millimeter Kodachrome footage. And this is another way in which I think Allen was a pioneer. Kodachrome was not introduced as a recording medium until 1936, so he was very eagerly glomming on to new technologies, even in those early years, and this is as a precocious 20-something. The film documentary that Jim Leary and I worked on marries the all-too-brief silent film footage that Lomax shot to audio disc recordings, which have been transferred of the same performers, which are existing now as digital transfers. I will be the first to admit that my initial confident enthusiasm at being able to sync the film to the recordings, this was based on seeing the microphone quite clearly into shot on several occasions in reviewing the film. That early enthusiasm quickly faded. As Jim and I started noodling around, that's a technical term and I don't want to unpack that for you right now, the absence of any recording logs, as Maggie mentioned before, the recordings are all too partial. They're partial in several senses of the words. The absence of recording logs or other notation about the filming and what music was being played at that exact moment rendered syncing a moot point. I've since become convinced that Allen actually just shot the performers while they were singing into the microphone but not recording them on disc. On several occasions, he takes performers outside of the interior of the house in order to get a better shot of them in the light. The shots are also quite short. I think the longest is probably maybe 45 seconds. I think we'll have one continuous shot. So Allen was basically turning the camera on and off to conserve films, moving around to do different angles. And here you'll get a sense of this in early developing ethnographic sensibility because there are a lot of full body shots, but also close-ups of performers' hands, of people tapping their feet, people keeping rhythm. And all really amazing, a nascent ethnographic sensibility emerging in the images. And as you heard from Maggie, the kind of the ways in which he later conveyed that to a whole subsequent generation of field workers and filmmakers is quite remarkable. Pete Seeger, whose collections we also have in the Library of Congress, another one of the collections that Todd curates, says very clearly that he started working on film because he saw Allen working on film sometime in the 1950s. So, you know, generationally, he begat a lot of he had a lot of progeny. So the choice of audio track, then returning to the film that I joined to the picture, is based solely on reasonable conjecture. Looking at the historical records, basically, if the Bel Airs were singing on that day, Jim and I said, "Well, let's just find a track of the Bel Airs which seems to most fit the scene," and we put them together. On several instances, I slowed the frame rate severely in the digital editing domain to accommodate a few more seconds of audio. So I cut, to use an old-fashioned term, picture to audio, doubling, sometimes tripling, slowing it down to the digital in the Final Cut Pro to stretch out as much film footage as I could without making it look too weird, although you can decide that. So in the finest tradition of Maoist-style self-criticism, I'll say that being a film guy and having grown up literally cutting 16-millimeter film together, digital film and video are in some respects markedly inferior to the analog material. Tip of the hat to Chris and folks here in the panel earlier today. But I will also have to say, again, in a similar sort of confessional mode, that the sorts of technical manipulation and tools that are available in the digital domain at the local level, that is to say in my little editing space, is quite remarkable these days. And I can do things that were only available in the olden days to well-equipped technical labs. So let me see if I can make this work. Excuse me, the brief interruption. So in this first clip, Lomax filmed the Floriani family, a Croatian tamburica group that also played more popular styles of music in the front yard of their home in Amik, Michigan. It's a town in the Copper Country, which is a reference to mining, the main industry in that part of the state. There are several shots of a mine in the first part of the clip under which the song 31st Level Blues is playing. That's in English, which is which the contrast is all the more remarkable, as you will see in the second song. The song's about mine work. 31st Level refers to the depths that miners have to descend to do their jobs, and the lyrics amplify the hard toil and weariness of the occupation and the antagonism that characterized relations between mine workers and bosses. You've got to understand that the Copper Country was a fairly hotbed of radicalism back in those days, and relationships between capitalist bosses and the workers were all too fraught. The second song by the same group, the Florianis, highlights a group facility as tamburicans, and the track used here is a traditional Croatian ballad, Majko Moja, My Mother. I think Nikki alluded to the fact that it's taken a sort of a small army of people working in four or five different states to try to put these materials together, either by making them accessible, doing the production, and doing the kind of digital repatriation or return to the communities. And this is one of those instances in which Richard March, a colleague of Jim Leary, was enlisted by Jim, I think working pro bono, to do the translations of the lyrics. The second clip after that features Mose and Exilia Belair, French-Canadian residents of Hancock, Michigan, singing Dime Pourquoi Un. It's a version of the Carol of the 12 Numbers, which has been documented throughout Europe and North America as far back as the mid-19th century. We had the help of both Jim's colleagues at the University of Wisconsin and Steve Winnick, our very own colleague at the Library of Congress, in tracking down and translating the lyrics. Following that, we'll move on to Edward King, or Edward Roy, as he says, doing foot tapping and singing his own composition. King was also quite a fine fiddler, working the lumber camps, as his other recordings from that period demonstrate. We then follow with two sets of Finnish performers, the Fredriksons and Ilona Hallinen. And finally, we end with the aforementioned performer on Todd's ebook, Apo Juhani. And I think this is, for me, one of the more interesting segments of the entire corpus of materials, like I said, the surviving materials. It's probably the earliest demonstration of Alan's ethnographic inclinations, the way in which he was looking at the broader cultural context in which cultural traditions and performers grew up and the kind of work that they did, and his interest in things like in ritual practice and so on. So without further ado, and hopefully all of this will work, let's start.
When the pot comes out and says, we're up both all alone. Show some breath, try to keep your breath. What makes the bad skin? As the day is hell on me. Tell the dark faces, don't they think they're all blue. Music is being played by Vladimir Floriani and his two sons, Vladimir Jr. and Zeko.
In Champion and Baraga, I found French ballad singers who still enjoy a ballad fest that lasted all night.
Dis-moi pourquoi toi, dis-moi pour quoi croire.
Il est trois de plus de tristement. Il n'a qu'un seul Dieu, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu.
Dis-moi pour quoi quatre, dis-moi pour quoi quatre.
80 lisses, les trois de plus, deux tristement, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu.
Dis-moi pourquoi cinq, dis-moi pourquoi cinq.
Saint livre de Moïse, les 80 lisses, les trois de plus, deux tristement, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu.
Dis-moi pourquoi six, dis-moi pourquoi six.
Jésus rendu placé aux noces de Cana, Saint livre de Moïse, les 80 lisses, les trois de but, deux tristement, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu.
Dis-moi pourquoi ça, dis-moi pourquoi ça.
Saint sacrement, Jésus rendu placé aux noces de Cana, Saint livre de Moïse, les 80 lisses, les trois de but. Deux tristement, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu, il n'a qu'un seul Dieu.
Dis-moi pourquoi vivre, dis-moi pourquoi.
Et je regarde ton Paris, voyons ton portrait. Et j'ai pendu mon catalan, et à chaque fois qu'elle lui frissonne, voyons mes anniversaires, il passe à fille en calvaire. Oh, voyons les amis, je crois, et voyons ce temps. J'ai ton ami, la forêt, trop que tes yeux répondaient, et j'ai fait qu'il le jour d'un an.
Through the Copper Country and south of it, Finnish singers generously furnished me with more material than I had time to record. Helenin, blonde, crisp hair, broad, full, prominent cheekbones splashed with pink, and a hearty male laugh crackling at the end.
Niin kun hän hetken tälle, ei oo mulla perintöä. Eikä muuta tavarata, siinä syönnä teitäni.
September 28th, Apo at the Spring, Mrs. Kavarup and son, Forster, Apo and me. Apo can cure people who are cursed. He can also curse people who insult him. To cure a burn, he brings ice from the north to cool the burn. He chips silver coin into the spring because money is evil if shined up.
Sano niin, yksi kappale veistelen siihen hopiarahasta ja sitten sanotaan, että lahjan anna auun otaa. Lauhunotan, Lahjananna ja Jaunota. Mopio kappale kuten ne lähtee. Ja sitten lukee isänneitä sitten pois, kun se lähtee. Sitten minä isänneitä, kun olisi taivaalta syystä, kun niin, että mä lähten pois. Oli silloin kallista vettä joku, niin on luettu rukouksia. No rukouksia siinä lähtee. Ja sitten on luettu sitä vettä vai vasta.
Sonny and old Oppo went into the bush to get twigs. He cut lepa twigs. The twigs had to be cut from the right-hand side in front of him. He cut the branches from three different trees and then prayed over them. He bathed Sonny then in the spring water, three handful. Sonny had to take the water with his right hand and bathe the right side of his face first, three times. Sonny told to face the east, toward Christ, had to kneel on the special stones at the west end of the spring. Tea of lepa had to boil until it was coffee-colored. Then a wine glass full taken in three gulps would cure you of anything whatsoever.
Ja sitten se lähtee, että saakka jo rupeaa rukoukset. Ja niin aina seuraavasti täällä kotona. Kyllä sitä sitten mitään minä niin. Siinä on monet rukoukset. Ja rukouksilla on paljon voimaa. Kyllä sen tiedä, että eikö sillä ole paljon voimaa tuolla kirjoitettua Jumalan sanaa. Ja mikään niin väkeä on se. Eikä mikään niin hyvä parantaa kuin se.
Do not intend to fetishize either fieldwork or the process of ethnography. It's really interesting to me that it's taken, as I've said, all these people, and you know, we're sitting around in all these different places doing all this work, and yet one man with vision went out 75 years ago or so and captured these traditions, which are still alive for us today, by the virtue of the fact that he was far-seeing enough to say that something like this needed to be sustained, protected, and preserved. And so I think, again, the passion that I think all of you bring here, we also try to bring to our own work at the Library of Congress, the American Folklife Center, and across the entire federal spectrum of the federal agencies. It'd be interesting to see what other stuff there is like this in our archives that might interest you in your own particular realms and your own particular domains to be doing something on a collaborative basis. We look forward to talking more with you and seeing you around. Thank you very much. Is this the question and or answer? And where is Carrie here? If any questions for Carrie? I'm not sure.
Yes, you have plenty of time for questions and answers.
Okay. Questions and answers and comments. Does anybody have any? Yes, sir.
You know what kind of camera Alan Lomax used?
We do not. We looked in the records, and it doesn't say. 16 millimeter, might have been a Brownie. I'm not quite sure. There's nothing.
And Quad B, how much footage in total?
Eight rolls?
Eight 100-foot reels.
Eight 100-foot reels?
Yes.
Total.
More, as we said, were stolen, disappeared somehow or the other. Appa Yohani apparently found out who it was by using
a dowsing stick
and a watchman, which he made in order to pin the blame on two young men, ne'er-do-wells, in that part. That's exactly where the film footage got stolen, apparently. We do not know that anything happened to them, do we?
No.
Okay. No questions?